is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah wa bithalika umirtu wa ana غير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The UN General Assembly Committee adopts an Iranian-drafted resolution that calls on nuclear-armed states to dismantle their nuclear arsenal. Pakistan's foreign minister tells Press TV that his country and Iran have adopted a joint counter-terrorism strategy. And Britain summons the French ambassador to London amid an escalating post-Brexit dispute over fishing rights. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, the UN General Assembly's first committee has adopted an Iranian-drafted resolution calling on nuclear-armed states to dismantle their entire nuclear arsenal. The resolution calls for an end to production of nuclear weapons and requires nuclear-armed states not to transfer such weapons to other countries. It also calls on the Israeli regime to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and allow UN inspectors to access its facilities. The adopted text says non-nuclear states would be given assurances that they would not be attacked or threatened with nuclear weapons. The United States and the Israeli regime were among the countries that voted against the document. Political commentator Romero Funes says the powerful Israeli lobbies in the United States have allowed the regime to avoid being held accountable for its nuclear weapons program.
There's a complete double standard when it comes to Israel. Israel claims to be the victim. Israel claims to be the weaker underdog. And that's part of the Zionist narrative that they have. They view themselves as the underdog, as people who are oppressed. And there's actually a really disgusting concept in Israeli foreign policy called the Samson option, which is this idea that if other powers attack Israel, that Israel has the power and the capability to bomb the whole world and bring the whole world down with it. So there's some really vicious ideology in Israeli foreign policy. And unfortunately, the Israeli lobby, AIPAC, and all these Zionist organizations in Washington, D.C., they run the U.S. empire. They decide who gets criticized and who doesn't. And that's why we haven't seen any criticism of Israel the way we have of Iran.
Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has called on the Security Council to force Israel to end its occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights.
In this context, the Security Council must live up to to its responsibility and compel the Israeli regime to end the occupation of the Syrian Golan and also stop immediately its aggressions against Syria. Aggressions and destabilizing measures of the Israeli regime constitute flagrant violations of international law and continue to threaten regional and international peace and security. The assassination on October
16, 2021. Safdar Avanci added, all occupying and uninvited foreign forces should leave Syria without any precondition or further delay. The Iranian envoy also spoke about what he described as the dire humanitarian situation in Syria. He said further efforts are needed to alleviate the Syrian sufferings and help reconstruction there. Safdar Avanci said to reach those goals, all unilateral and coercive sanctions against Syria should be removed, among other measures. He said those sanctions are only used for collective punishment of the entire population in Syria. Tehran says the upcoming round of talks with the remaining signatories of the 2015 nuclear deal will be solely aimed at the removal of anti-Iran sanctions.
What is seriously important in the new round of talks is whether the other side is ready to make serious decisions on the removal of the illegal and cruel sanctions.
Baghari Kani, also serving as the chief Iranian negotiator in the talks, made the comments upon arrival in the Russian capital. He said he will discuss bilateral ties and the latest regional and international developments with Russian officials. The Iranian negotiator is in Moscow following his visit to the Belgian capital. In Brussels, he met with the coordinator of the Joint Commission of the Iran Nuclear Deal, Enrique Mora. Baghari Kani has said they agreed to begin discussion before the end of November. The exact date will be announced next week. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has condemned the unjust campaign led by Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and their allies against a Lebanese official who called for an end to the war on Yemen. Hezbollah also praised the courageous and honorable position of Information Minister George Kordahi in defending the oppressed people of Yemen. Kordahi, whose remarks prompted backlash from Riyadh and its allies, had said in an interview that the war was futile and said it was time for the war to end. He also defended Yemen's Ansar Allah resistance movement, saying it is defending against an external aggression, adding that homes and villages, funerals and weddings were being bombed by the Saudi-led coalition. Following the October 25th remarks, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Kuwait summoned Lebanon's ambassadors to their respective capitals to protest the official statements. Maryam Saleh is our correspondent in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and joins us now. Maryam, so the Lebanese information minister has been condemned by Saudi Arabia and its allies for just stating the facts regarding Yemen, a country that is on the brink of famine because of a Saudi-led war.
Exactly, and these statements are not new concerning someone who is Lebanese, but also we have heard these from international leaders. We have heard them from United Nations Head of Security Council, United Nations Secretary General, Mr. Guterres. We've heard it from other officials in the world saying that this is an absurd war that needs to stop. This has led to destruction, mass killings. It has led to famine for the people of Yemen. He did not say something new. However, with the fact that Saudi Arabia does have a clinch to Lebanon and tends to try to put pressure on Lebanese politics, this is something they want to use here as a card in Lebanon, especially with the fact that these statements were made by Mr. Kordahi before he actually took office, and so before he became minister. So this, how did they basically try to find those statements, look for them, and then use them against him, and now against this cabinet, which is was the only hope for the Lebanese to try to get out of the socioeconomic crisis. So that is one thing, and we're seeing this pressure now being basically as a campaign, a political campaign, and pressure against the cabinet, trying to force Mr. Qaddafi to resign. Now, let me just give you a background on Mr. Qaddafi. This was a person who worked for decades in the Saudi satellite channels, and he has very prominent TV shows. And once he spoke and once he became vocal about his support for the resistance in Lebanon after the liberation of 2000 and after the war in 2006, then he was forced to resign from those the big corporations, and he was sacked from his job because he was vocal about people's resistance against occupation. So this is not new for with Saudi Arabia. And so what we're witnessing today is actually basically Saudi Arabia using its tools here in Lebanon, those political parties that are with it, even the fact that the cabinet itself is trying to say that what he said only represents him and represented him before the cabinet. So we're not sure if now there's a lot of pressure being put on Qaddafi. If this does lead to the fact that this cabinet enforces Mr. Qaddafi to resign, then there will be a bigger crisis, I think, internal crisis, because there are so many groups, not only Hezbollah, but even those who believe in the freedom of speech here in Lebanon, which has been generally the case, then this will also lead, of course, to a lot of protests and opposition from those groups here in Lebanon.
Thank you very much, Mariam. As always, Mariam Saleh, our correspondent, joining us live from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Now, Pakistan's Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi says the United States' chaotic withdrawal and the fleeing of former Afghan officials set the breeding ground for terrorist groups like Daesh in Afghanistan.
You're saying Pakistan was advocating consistently withdraw, but do it in an orderly fashion, you know, and that will help stabilize things in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, the way Ashraf Ghani and his entire team, the way they capitulated and left, that created such a uncertainty that elements like such took advantage of. And you saw what happened at the airport, where innocent lives were affected. So, yes, that sudden withdrawal contributed to the confusion.
The top Pakistani diplomat was speaking with Press TV. He said terrorism is one of the main challenges facing Afghanistan today. Qureshi said Islamabad does not want to see Daesh footprint expanding in the region, adding a coordinated approach is needed to address the problem. International assistance, Qureshi said, can help prevent the economic collapse of Afghanistan. The Pakistani foreign minister told us his country has not agreed to allow the US to use its airspace for intelligence and military operations on Afghanistan. Regarding Iran, he said Tehran and Islamabad have recently increase their cooperation to stop terrorist attacks near their joint borders.
The spoilers within Afghanistan and beyond, who do not want to see stability in the region, right? They do not want to see stability within Afghanistan. So they always try to create misunderstandings. But fortunately, Pakistan, in the last 3 years since our government came into office, our bilateral relations with Iran have improved considerably. We have a mechanism in place now. We have structures in place through which we can coordinate, share intelligence.
Qureshi highlighted the importance of Islamabad's recent agreement on counterterrorism with Tehran. He said the two sides have adopted a joint strategy to deal with terrorist attacks. The top Pakistani diplomat also said border violence has significantly declined in recent years. The two neighbors, he added, want to see a stable and peaceful region and are looking to expand their economic cooperation. The war on Syria has had many different players, with Turkey and the US remaining active on the battlefield, yet they don't see eye to eye on one issue, and that is how to deal with the YPG Kurdish fighters. Turkey sees them as a threat, but the US is backing them in their so-called fight against Daesh terrorists. Still, Washington and Ankara remain united on one issue. That's Syria's democratically elected President Bashar al-Assad has to be ousted.
Turkey has dispatched truckloads of military and logistical equipment to northern Syria. Syrian media say that two convoys of 100 trucks each, carrying battle tanks, artillery batteries, and logistical supplies, cross into Syrian territories through Khirbet al-Jaz crossing. They reportedly headed towards Jabal al-Zawiya area in Syria's northwestern province of Idlib. Syria's official news agency, Sana'a, citing local sources, said that dozens of Turkish military trucks loaded with various ammunition and logistical supplies, as well as armored personnel carriers, entered Syrian territories. The convoy later headed toward positions held by Turkish-backed militants in the city of Ras al Ain. Turkey says the deployment is part of a plan to launch attacks on U.S.-backed Kurdish YPG forces. The deployment is also to fortify the position of Turkish military forces in northwest Syria and help Tekfiri militants fighting Syrian government troops. Idlib is the last major stronghold of foreign-backed terrorists. Most of them are members of the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham militant group. They are fighting against the legitimate government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
So Turkey preparing or suggesting that it may launch yet again another invasion of Syria into what is sometimes referred to as Kurdistan against the YPG, the pro-U.S., anti-Assad militia groups that are comprised majority on the Syrian-Turkish border is going to put us into a political climate that is maybe tricky to figure out, to say the least.
Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's territorial integrity. Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019 after Turkish military forces launched a long-threatened cross-border invasion in a declared attempt to push fighters of the Kurdish People's Protection Units, YPG, away from the border areas.
Now, Britain has summoned the French ambassador to London as a post-Brexit dispute over fishing rights escalates between the two sides. London has criticized what it's called a confrontational language by Paris. On Wednesday, France fined two British boats fishing off its port, Le Havre, and detained one of them. France says Britain should honour its post-Brexit commitments, demanding more licences for its vessels to access British waters. It has also announced retaliatory measures starting from November the 2nd. Paris, at the same time, has expressed readiness to hold talks to resolve the months-long standoff. Earlier, Britain accused France of violating trade deals and international law. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned. The Light is up next.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate.
praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The all-knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepest me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight. The British government must tackle the climate crisis with the same urgency seen at the start of the COVID pandemic. According to in-depth research that also found widespread support for nationalization and skepticism over the role of the private sector. The Net Zero Diaries, a project run by the consultancy Britain Thinks, to examine evolving attitudes to the pursuit of a net zero emissions target, found support for strong-arm tactics from the government, even among those who said they had low engagement with environmental issues. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's chief political correspondent, Jessica Elgott. The piece is titled, Climate Crisis Needs Same Urgency Seen at Start of COVID Pandemic. The British government must tackle the climate crisis with the same urgency seen at the start of the COVID pandemic, according to in-depth research that also found widespread support for nationalization and skepticism over the role of the private sector. The Net Zero Diaries, a project run by the consultancy Britain Thinks, to examine evolving attitudes to the pursuit of a net zero emissions target, found support for strong-arm tactics from the British government, even among those who said they had low engagement with environmental issues. When the government wanted to be proactive with getting COVID deaths down, they took a proactive and committed approach. But who paid for it? The government, of course, one participant in the research observed. Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng are said to have been motivated by the pandemic to take a more radical approach towards net zero emissions. A source close to the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, said both had reflected on the damage catastrophic events could wreak on the economy and used those arguments to make the case for greater safeguards against climate events. The focus group project involved 40 people keeping diaries of news events and their everyday climate encounters and hearing from a range of experts across the political spectrum. The research was commissioned by the energy company OVO, Citizens Advice, the World Wildlife Fund, and Lancaster University, and diarists were recruited to reflect differing views on climate from engaged activists to low-engagement regular consumers. It found some sympathy with the aims of direct action groups such as Insulate Britain, but a widespread belief that civil disobedience would not work as a tactic. Ahead of COP26 next week, the project also found there was cynicism over what the summit in Glasgow will deliver and concern about the amount of emissions it will produce. Several respondents suggested there was an irony in gathering leaders from different corners of the world when many major conferences were successfully held online during the pandemic. Diarists regularly came back to the idea of coordinated national action and saw nationalisation as the simplest way to achieve this. The Labour Party in particular has faced controversy over Keir Starmer's reluctance to back a previous pledge to nationalise energy companies. I like the idea of that personally, even though I know there were lots of problems with the nationalised companies we had in the old days, one participant said. Participants were asked to examine the most recent manifestos of the four main British political parties, with the majority choosing the Scottish Nationalist Party, the SNP, as being the most appealing, citing its focus on national companies and timeframes that seemed achievable. The Green Party was the second most popular party, with Labour and the Conservatives joint bottom amid criticism of platitudes such as commitments to tree planting and a distrust of nuclear energy. The participants said they did not trust the private sector to drive a shift to net zero emissions, a key plank of the government's strategy designed to incentivize companies to reorient their research and development towards cheaper, greener solutions. Despite hearing from speakers who argued that the private sector innovation was crucial and that change could be driven by the free market, the participants said they roundly disagreed and argued companies would always maximize profits. Instead, the participants said regulation should be much tougher and sanctions should be applied to companies unwilling to comply. Yet, there was a strong reluctance towards individuals bearing the brunt of the cost, defaulting towards a belief that big industry should be the first call for higher taxation. Minister was also concerned that the less well-off, or those in precarious jobs, will need support. Unless there is good retraining to send these people into green jobs, then they're heading for permanent unemployment, probably as the Yorkshire coal miners did in the 1980s. A generation of people not working, the poverty, one participant said. Most said they were reluctant to change their diet and underlined the high cost of changing their cars or energy supply. "We are naturally meat eaters and changing that is not practical," one participant said. "I keep wanting to trade in a diesel Kia Sportage for an e-vehicle. But the costs are astonishingly high and it would be £40,000 plus to change," said another. "Who can afford that?" One diarist said they wanted to see the government install solar panels and energy-efficient boilers free of charge if they are serious about becoming more energy efficient. The participants were skeptical of campaigners that sought to highlight the racist aspects of the climate crisis and the effects on the developing world, as well as arguments about intergenerational fairness, and said their views were more shaped by current inequalities, citing the need to protect poorer citizens from fuel poverty and retrain people in green industries. Participants will continue to keep their diaries for another 2 months and report back after the COP26 summit in Glasgow.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Midstream.
In the aftermath of the Beirut Tayuni massacre of October 14th, Lebanese forces militia leader Samir Jaja was summoned by Lebanon's military court for questioning over a shooting attack on a peaceful demonstration, resulting in the martyrdom of 6 protesters and one mother of 5 inside her own house. The summon follows incriminating confessions given by some of the arrested Lebanese forces members, which took the investigation file into the Tayuni massacre to a whole new level. This development is a serious indication that there is an intention by the Intelligence Directorate to expand the investigation beyond the moment of the outbreak of armed clashes and its aftermath. Intel information revealed that during the interrogation of a number of suspects belonging to the Lebanese forces militia in the Tayuni massacre, testimonies confirmed information that was already in possession of the security services about armed groups affiliated with the Lebanese forces, which usually do not make a move except with the knowledge of party leader Samir Jaja and with direct orders from him. The movements of these groups were recorded the night before the events of Tayune in both Ain Rimani and Ashrafieh stronghold areas for Jaja thugs in Beirut. The investigators considered that the detainees' statements led to the suspicion of a pre-planned scheme, which began to be implemented the night before the Tayune ambush. The Directorate of Intelligence and the Military Public Prosecution supervising the investigation put the detainee's statements and the available information in the context of the TV interview that Jaja conducted after the Tayuni incident, in addition to his previous statements, in which an adoption of responsibility was clear on behalf of Jaja concerning the Tayuni attack. Based on this data, Lebanese military court judge Fadi Aqiqi asked the Intelligence Directorate to summon Jaja to the investigation to hear his testimony. What was warlord Jaja's reaction to the court summoning? The convicted felon simply refused to appear before the military court over the Tayuni clashes if Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is not also summoned. I kid you not, this is what he actually said. The man just ignored the fact that the Directorate of Intelligence was moving according to confessions and testimonies made by the suspects in its custody, which intersected with information contained in security reports about the movement of armed groups from Jaja's headquarters in Ma'rab to Beirut on the same night of the incident. To up the ante against Jaja's lame position, it was even indicated by eyewitnesses in the area where the first sniper shot was fired that they were surprised that morning by young men from the Lebanese forces wearing black t-shirts bearing the image of a crossed-out cross dispersed in the inner streets of Ain Rimene. The real endgame of the Lebanese forces is to ignite civil war that would lead to demographic change. This is what the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, concluded after the Tayuni ambush. But apparently, it was game over for Jaja before it had even started. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Prominent development was recorded last week in Beirut in the investigation file into the Tayuni massacre, with the decision of the government commissioner to the military court, Judge Fadi Aie, to summon the head of the Lebanese forces militia, Samir Jaja, against the background of investigations conducted by the Intelligence Directorate. This indicates a real intention of the Lebanese security apparatus to delve into the available data regarding the night before the clashes, after information was available indicating that there was an intent to prepare for a confrontation, or at least to draw the resistance camp into an armed clash. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is retired Army General Elias Farhat. Thank you very much for being with us, General. Now, the military court has summoned Lebanese forces militia leader Samir Jaja at the backdrop of the testimonies over the deadly clashes in Al Tayuni massacre in the light of the confessions of many of the detainees in custody of the authorities in Lebanon. Now, we have conflicting reports concerning whether he will attend or not, and this week we had new developments concerning summoning him to the Ministry of Defense in the Yerzeh of Lebanon. If he does not attend, will it actually backfire on him? Does he have an option not to attend?
First of all, things have changed today, definitely in the afternoon, when websites published a written subpoena by the Lebanese Army Intelligence calling Samir Jaja to come to Yerzeh, to the Director of Intelligence, which was different from what was circulated before, that the government commissioner in the military court summoned him to the military court. Now things changed. He will undergo an investigation in the military intelligence, which is something different. And Samir Jaja himself had an experience with this intelligence in the 90s when they arrested him for and was convicted and stayed about 11 years in that jail. So now it's different. Now, whether Samir Jaja will attend or not, that depends upon the his calculations, exactly, the political calculations. Really, he was surprised by the summon of the commissioner, government commissioner in the military court, and this surprise embarrassed him, so he didn't make his mind yet to whether will appear or not before the intelligence investigator. If he did appear, that means he will give in to the military intelligence, and that will cancel all his proud and all his prejudicial words against the intelligence and other services. And
but
he
General,
not,
in case he decides not to show up,
yes,
to the
if
what
he,
will happen?
Okay, if he did not appear and decide this and he make his decision not to appear before the military intelligence, then legally speaking, the commissioner has right to refer him to the just judge magistrate, and the magistrate will may arrest him in absent, which means that he will be wanted for all the law enforcement posts all over the country and the crossing borders.
What you are talking about is definitely something new, a new development, a risky one for the entire country, but somewhat a fair one for the people that fell in the Tayune massacre. But we have intel information from the Lebanese army that revealed that during the interrogation of a number of the detainees belonging to the Lebanese forces militia about the Tayune massacre, their testimonies confirmed the information that we spoke about earlier concerning pre-planned maybe schemes and having armed groups affiliated with Jaja brought into Beirut from Arab, from Ashrafieh, from Kisirwen, or from other areas with direct orders from Samir Jaja himself. If that is proving to be true, will Jaja be convicted of a terror attack? And if so, what would his sentence be?
Yes, this was published in the media, and people talk about the snipers and the units from the Lebanese forces who came before, and the coordination between the organizers of the march towards the Palace of Justice and the intelligence officers in Tayuni, both from the army and from the internal security forces. They also said that there were some people who came from outside Ain al-Rumaini and went to some stories, high stories in the region, and shoot at the march of the people and cause the casualties. I think now we are in front of a judicial operation, mm-hmm. where this summoning was all under the incriminating confessions of the detainees who determined directly that the people, the armed people who shot fire at the demonstrators were units from Ma'rab, the headquarters of Dr. Samir Jaja. This evidences or this these testimonies enabled the commissioner, the government commissioner in the military court, to appoint Samir Jaja personally, mm-hmm. to the Yerzi head.
Samir Jaja was very frank and crystal clear in the last interview that he had, and he had a condition. He said, I'm okay with that. I would go only if the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, is also summoned. We're talking about 7 civilians who fell as martyrs as a result of Jaja's personal involvement in this. Is there legal ground for the military court to summon the Secretary General of Hezbollah?
His appearance before the military intelligence or before the court is the testimonies and to try to include Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in this case is nonsense, because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is a party commander, and you know he does not seem. And even if some people that support Hezbollah were heard or seen in the area carrying weapons after they evacuated the killed people at the injured. That means they came by themselves as a reaction and not as a plan which the intelligence of the army and the internal security forces are fully aware that the armed elements of the Lebanese forces who were in the other side in Ain al-Rabbani shoot at the people. That's something different to combine himself with Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is something strange.
So there is no legal ground
for that. Nobody buy it.
There is no legal ground for what Samir Jaja was saying.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we're out of time here. I want to thank you very much, retired Army General Mr. Elias Farhat, for joining us to talk about this very huge development in Lebanon. We're going to see how this role will go throughout the week and next week in Lebanon as well. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking at a different development out in the Syrian desert.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, although the attack carried out by the axis of resistance forces in Syria on the American base of Al-Tanf is linked to the recent Israeli raids that targeted an overnight camp in the Homs desert about 10 days ago, it is not possible to separate this attack from the new strategy that is taking path to uproot the American occupation forces from Syria through both political and military pressure. The latest attack, which appears to have been carried out by the Syrian Allies Operations Room, which includes several factions in response to the Israeli-American raids that targeted one of its sites near Palmyra, was very precise as the drones penetrated the 55-kilometer-long fortified area, reaching the base and successfully carrying out its mission. Explosions rock a 10th base in this following report.
Forces of Syria's allies carried out their promise to respond to the joint Israeli-American aggression that targeted positions occupied by the former's forces near the city of Palmyra in the eastern countryside of Homs about 10 days ago, which led to a number of martyrs and wounded. On Thursday, October 21st, Syria's allies carried out their threat as bomber drones targeted the residence of American occupation soldiers, in addition to a kitchen and food warehouse inside the At-Tanf base, located on the border triangle between Syria, Iraq, and Jordan. The retaliatory attack came in conjunction with missiles targeting the base and its surroundings, which led to several explosions igniting a fire inside the base. So far, we have not been able to determine the extent of the casualties. But what we know is that the explosions and fire were followed by heavy flight of American helicopters. Meanwhile, the Pentagon did confirm the targeting of its troops base in At-Tanf, noting that no casualties among the American forces was recorded. What was remarkable about Thursday's retaliatory attack on the American occupation base is that it did not come in response to a traditional Israeli aggression. On the day following the operation, the leadership of the Syria Allies Operations Room issued a statement confirming that it had taken a decision to respond harshly to the aggression on Palmyra. In parallel with a statement that vowed to respond, the leadership of the Allied Forces of Resistance in Syria issued instructions to its forces to implement a wide deployment plan in preparation for an escalation that may follow the inevitable response to the aggression. The U.S. occupation's choice to reside in the At-Tanf region in the Syrian desert was not arbitrary, but came after a careful study of the map of the region, where the base is located on a border triangle overlooking Iraq and Jordan on one side and the Syrian depth on the other. Also, the base is located on the shortest road linking Damascus with Baghdad and then Tehran, which enables Washington to achieve a set of goals, whether it is supervising the region and the ability it provides for rapid movement, or being stationed at a point that can be considered a stumbling block for Iran, which the United States considers of most importance. the attempted attack embedded a set of messages, most notably the ability that the resistance forces possessed to break American fortifications, in addition to confirming the continuation of the pressing military confrontation, especially since these attacks were preceded by other similar attacks against American forces' positions in northeastern Syria, most notably the attack on the Al-Umar oil field, which Washington controls in the areas of deployment of the Kurdish separatist forces near Deir ez-Zor last July. This last operation also paves the way for the next stage of confrontation with the Israeli entity, with a direct message that any other Israeli aggression will be met with response, regardless of the areas from which they were launched, even if they are the areas where American occupation forces are deployed. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is author and academic and Australian coordinator of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance, Dr. Tim Anderson. Thank you very much for being with us, Tim. The attack against a U.S. occupation base in the Syrian desert in the Atenf area carried a set of messages, most notably the ability that these resistance forces possessed to actually break American fortifications in the heart of Syria. It's a triangle that is very, very effective towards targeting the inner part of Syria. Are such attacks inside Syria left for retaliatory defensive measures by this Friends of Syria group against these U.S. forces, or have this now shifted into a complete new strategy against the occupation?
I think it's still defensive strategy by and large. There's a huge amount of resentment at the occupation in eastern Syria, and let's remember that the attacks on Syrian forces are co-coordinated with Qassad, with the Kurdish separatists in the northeast and the east. That is to say, they have been transporting DAC operatives from their prisons, from various parts of the northeast, down to towards Deir ez-Zor and towards Al-Tanf. So there is a great coordination between the occupation in the southern border and all along the eastern border with Iraq.
Well, the recent military escalation coincided with both political and military moves on several domains, including the continuous Russian and Turkish pressures to remove American forces from Syria, as Ankara, it's a bit funny for me, but Ankara considers the Americans' presence as an occupation and only there to protect what they say the Kurdish forces, at a time when Russia considers this presence an obstacle to a comprehensive political solution for the global war on Syria, and Syria definitely agrees with the latter logic. So the majority of all sides taking part in the conflict agree with the necessity to remove the American occupation from Syria. Is that enough, though, for the Biden administration to actually just pick up its stuff and go back home?
No, of course, and the words don't really match the action, do they? In fact, some of the Security Council resolutions in recent years have been fairly good in words in terms of the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Syria, the Syrian-led process, and so on. But, of course, neither Erdogan nor the U.S. have been applying those in reality, and they've both been continuing to support their own proxies to try and keep Syria divided and weak and destabilized, basically. So there is, of course, a process going on now, as I understand, that the U.S. is talking to the Russians, and the separatist Kurds are talking to the Russians and to the Europeans and trying to figure out which way to jump when the U.S. pulls out. I think it's a foregone conclusion the U.S. is going to pull out, but they are looking for the conditions to save face and to try and maintain some of the destabilization they've managed with the various proxy groups that they are still controlling.
Well, part of the proxy groups that you're talking about that the Americans actually control are the Kurdish separatists to the north and the northeast, and also we have this new Maghawir al-Thawra, which is, the name by itself, with Wahhabis being their part of that name, is just funny for me. But which of these mercenaries are more likely to stick with what the U.S. wants rather than just drop the U.S. like a hot potato, just like the U.S. has always been dropping them all like a hot potato?
Yes, well, there is a different character with the Wahhabi Takfiri groups, isn't there, to the separatist Kurds. The separatist Kurds initially were armed against Daesh by the Syrian government, and so there has not been serious confrontation between the Syrian army and the Kurdish separatists up until now. But they're very weak, they're fragmented, they entirely depend on the U.S. occupation, they are having a great corrosive impact on security and food security and damaging education and health in that region. But they are not of the same character as that. Now, you see, when the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan, they've left behind a present to the Afghan people of Daesh K to destabilize and cause problems for the Afghan people. And I think there's every reason to believe they're going to try and maintain that in Syria. But nevertheless, they're looking for a withdrawal from Syria that doesn't allow the whole Qassad separatist Kurdish collapse. But that's a huge challenge because it seems...
Well, Tim, you had quite a journey in the past couple of weeks that I really want to hear about. You've been on a tour in the northern part of Syria, liberated area, especially after all the havoc that they had to endure in areas that were stricken hard by the war. What can you tell us about the community there, especially in the northern part of the country, especially at a time when the unilateral American punitive measures against all Syrian people are really hitting hard?
Yes, well, it's interesting. For me, the most striking things were to see the very strong presence of the Syrian state in the northeast, in Hasakeh province, in the major cities of Qamishli and Hasakeh, for example. There is a strong presence of the army, of the public health system. Even the councils are still in place, although semi-dormant, basically. But most striking of all was the schools, that there's been a huge influx of students from all around the province into the Syrian syllabus schools, because the Kurdish school system effectively has collapsed. They've closed most of the schools, taken them over for other purposes. The ones that are running a syllabus that's not recognized anywhere. And so the most striking thing for me was to see thousands and thousands of young students flocking into the Syrian syllabus schools in Hasakeh city and then going out again trying to avoid the Qassad checkpoints because they're being harassed there. But just to say that there's a huge vote by the families of the children in Hasakeh, a vote of confidence in the Syrian school system, and that's an extraordinary thing I didn't expect to see.
That's after 11 years of global war on Syria. This sounds a bit optimistic in this puddle of unsafety that Syria was living throughout the years. Thank you very much for your insights, Tim Anderson from Damascus, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
In the limelight.
Recordings from a 2019 panel discussion of the U.S. Council for National Policy revealed that former U.S. President Donald Trump's tax cuts for the rich were sparked by personal conversations. We'll prepare for you an article written by Jason Wilson. The piece is titled How a Secretive Conservative Group Influenced Trump's Tax Cuts. Documents and recordings obtained by The Guardian shed new light on a powerful and secretive right-wing network and the influence it was able to exert on former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration and policies favoring the super-rich. The recordings include speeches given to the Council for National Policy, or CNP, by conservative media stars including Dennis Prager, emerging Republican power players such as Charlie Kirk, and close economic advisors to Donald Trump. Some of the previously published recordings appear to no longer be publicly available. The Guardian's independently sourced recordings offer an insight into how conservative economic thinkers from bodies representing the interests of some of the richest individuals in the country were able to exert influence on the supposed populist Donald Trump. In particular, a panel discussion at the Council for National Policy, CNP's February 2019 meeting, suggests that Donald Trump decided one of his most far-reaching economic policies on very limited evidence, on the basis of a personal conversation. The panel involved Bill Walton, president of the Council for National Policy, CNP. The Washington Times columnist and former member of the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority, Richard Rahn. Jonathan Williams, chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. And Stephen Moore, a one-time Donald Trump nominee for the Federal Reserve Board, whose nomination was withdrawn following revelations that he had failed to pay his ex-wife hundreds of thousands of dollars in alimony. The panelists offered a favorable assessment of the Trump administration's economic performance, but also used the platform to claim credit for pushing the Trump administration in the direction of radical free market policies. Stephen Moore claimed that he, together with Larry Kudlow, Donald Trump's director of the National Economic Council from 2018, had persuaded the then-president Donald Trump to offer unprecedented corporate tax cuts. He described a meeting with Trump where they argued that the United States' corporate tax rate relative to those among certain Asian and European competitors